I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. While men hold more positions of power in the corporate and political worlds than women, and generally get paid more than women for the same job, they're also more likely to be in prison, be a mass murderer or terrorist, be in special education, get suspended from school, and be a victim of a violent crime. Today in Radio Times, we want to take a critical look at how we raise our boys, how we counter the messages that tell them to swallow their feelings, and help us look behind the bravado of macho toughness, of hypermasculinity. And we have two guests who have joined us on the show. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Michael Reichert. He's a psychologist in clinical practice. He's a consultant at the Haverford School. That's an all-boys prep school in suburban Philadelphia. He's also executive director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives at the University of Pennsylvania. Writes a column for Yahoo News called The Me Too Guide to Raising Boys. And he's got a forthcoming book, How to Raise a Boy. Michael Reichert, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
And nice to have Michael Lindsay with us as well. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. He's the executive director of the McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research, and also the Constance and Martin Silver Professor of Poverty Studies at New York University. Michael Lindsay, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Michael, let me begin with you. I mean, girls are held to difficult, impossible standards. They have to deal with stereotypes and sexism and harassment and all of that. What are the pressures that boys are under, especially boys to grow up to be men?
I think Michael, she means me.
We do have two Michaels,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, the notion of stereotypes that we've applied to people of color, to women, to gay children and so forth, I think also applies to males from the time that they're born. I have a friend who was pregnant with twins. She actually taught biology in a school, and she knew that one of the babies she was carrying was a boy and one was a girl. And she said to me, "I know which one's the boy." And I said, "How did you know?" She said, "He's the one who kicks me all the time."
I knew she was going to say that.
A wonderful book, The Courage to Raise Good Men by Olga Silverstein, who was a really famous therapist at the Ackerman Institute in New York City. She cited a research study in which a camera was hidden in the waiting room of a doctor's office, and a woman carrying a baby dressed in white came into the waiting room. Other patients were waiting as well. And the nurse came and said, "It's your turn to see the doctor." She handed the baby alternately, dressed in white, alternately to people in the waiting room, saying, "This is my daughter. Would you mind holding her for just a second while I consult with the doctor? This is my son. Would you mind holding him while I consult with the doctor?" And in both cases, what they filmed was a very different treatment.
With a tiny baby?
With a tiny baby dressed in white. What they found was that when the baby was identified as a female, the baby was held close, talked to, smiled at. When the baby was identified as a male, within 30 seconds, he was on the floor playing with keys.
Hmm.
And Olga Silverstein talked about the abandonment, the systematic abandonment. Another book that I would mention, Kate Lombardi-Stone wrote a book called The Mama's Boy Myth. The pressure that mothers feel not to spoil their son's masculinity by keeping them too close. All of this amounts to what Bill Pollack, a psychologist at Harvard who wrote the book Real Boys, he called the traumatic abrogation of boys' holding environments. Another way to say abandonment.
Abandonment. Let me have you hold on to that thought and get Michael Lindsay in on the conversation. How do you see the pressures that boys are under?
Well, I think Michael, the other Michael, hit it really well. I think the notion of labels and sort of this force feeding boys into a really strong identification with a masculine sort of ethic really blunts their emotional expressions and does not give them the opportunity to emote in ways that are salient to their well-being. I think that certainly there's a lot of force feeding into that, what it means to be a man, as you've indicated, boys don't cry and that sort of thing. And I think that it becomes really problematic when boys are not given that opportunity to have a range of emotional expression. So I think those kinds of issues certainly characterize, you know, how we socialize boys. And I'm really glad we're having this conversation because we need to bring more light to the matter, for sure.
Well, and it just must be said that the boys feel everything that girls feel. I'm looking at you, Michael Reichert, but it's not as if boys have one set of emotions and girls have another set of emotions. We're all human beings. We all feel scared at times. We all feel lonely at times.
Yeah, in fact, the research is clear on that subject. You know, boys are born at least as emotionally expressive as girls. An organization that I'm connected to in Washington, D.C., called Promundo, which is a global leader in gender justice, recently conducted a study that they called the Man Box Study. And what they found was that they found a few things. Just as Michael was suggesting, they found that when you suppress boys' emotions because you teach them that they have to adopt a certain persona or put on a mask, what results from that are higher levels of depression, higher levels of suicidality, higher levels of violence. What struck me, though, was one question in the survey that they conducted, and this was a study done in England, the U.S., and Mexico. U.S. was the leader in these negative outcomes, by the way.
That's interesting.
What they found was that when they asked the young men, where did they get these ideas, where did they feel the pressure to conform to this man box, they identified their parents as being the primary socializing agents.
What are parents afraid of? And let me put that back to you then, Michael. We've got two Michaels going here, Michael Reichert with us here in our Philadelphia studio and Michael Lindsay up in New York. So I'll be using first and last name so there is no confusion here. But talking about that man box, and I know, Michael Lindsay, you work with boys of color. Is there something even more constraining when it comes to boys of color and this range of emotions we've been talking about?
I think it is. When you look at what it means to be a person of color and the sort of overarching pressures related to race and ethnicity, there's certainly a hypersensitivity. And granted, rightly so, in terms of the experiences, historical legacy, if you will, of racism and discrimination. I do have a powerful anecdote. A good friend of mine, I went to Morehouse College in undergrad, and a good friend of mine who's a Harvard-trained lawyer who went to Morehouse with me was telling me about an incident where his son had been over at a play date, and you know, they were the parents were inside and the kids were outside playing. His son came in and was crying, and my friend and his wife asked their son what happened, and the son said that someone kicked him, and immediately the mom went into consoling her son and sort of telling him that's going to be okay, don't worry about it. And my friend said, no, get back outside and fight. And so his explication to his wife was that, you know, I don't want my son, my black son, to grow up in the world where he takes things from people, because if not, he's going to be taken advantage of. And so oftentimes we think about the context of poverty and how it makes one hypervigilant to your surroundings because of crime and other kind of deleterious aspects of what it means to be in a poverty-impacted environment. But that one anecdote suggests that I think there's a range of this sort of perception and experience among black men that because of the experiences, you know, historically and otherwise, that black men have traditionally been involved in terms of what it means to me black in America makes black men sort of think about their vulnerability on a constant basis and raise their sons in a way that they think are going to empower them in those moments when they're, you know, particularly feeling vulnerable.
Sure, and I don't want to get back to that, but you have a very similar story, Michael Reichert, with you and your son.
Yes, Michael, as you were telling that story, I was smiling because my wife and I, lived in an urban neighborhood in the early years of our marriage, and our son was born there, and loved going down to the playground, which was half a block away, hung out with his buddies down there, grew up on this, you know, on the sidewalks, riding their big wheels and so forth. But as he got older, some of the boys that he was hanging around with got tougher and meaner, and eventually a number of them, the meanest of them, sort of turned on my son and drove him from the playground, excluded him from their games, and he would come home really dejected and defeated by this way that these guys had turned against him. We're talking about 5 and 6 years old here.
Yeah, it's tough out there sometimes.
And it happened again and again, and I tried at first to play with him and just strengthen his self-concept, you know, strengthen his inner kind of fortitude. But at one day, I just thought, I don't think I'm handling this right, because he's continuing to turn away from the challenge, basically. And all of a sudden, I was filled with these worries, worries that his life was going to be forever smaller, that he was going to be forever defeated by the boys on the corner and so forth. And so I met him in front of our house. We lived in a row house section of Philadelphia. I met him outside, and I said, "You can't come in. You have to turn around and go back there, and you have to figure out how to remain a part of that game that you want to play. You can't let yourself be defeated by this. I'll help you. I'll think with you. I'll be here for you to come back to again and again. But you can't allow this to be the final story." And my son just was overwhelmed with the stress and pressure of this and fell apart. 5 years old, and, you know, big meltdown out there on the sidewalks of urban Philadelphia. My neighbors were peering out their doors, and my son
is
screaming.
What the heck is going on here, right?
What is this guy doing? But I I was so uncertain inside myself. Am I just passing along an intergenerational prejudice, or was I, in fact, believing in my son and his creative ability to solve this problem? That's the story.
Well, I want to find out how the story ended. That's Michael Reichert, who joins us along with Michael Lindsay. And we're talking about raising boys, the kind of pressures that boys, I think, and dads and parents feel in raising boys. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guest today about how to raise boys to be able to express the full range of emotions that they have. Joining us from the NPR studios is Michael Lindsay, and he's executive director of the McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research, also professor of poverty studies at New York University. Michael Reichert here with us in our Philadelphia studios. He's a psychologist in clinical practice, a consultant at the Haverford School, executive director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives, writes a column for Yahoo News called The Me Too Guide to Raising Boys, and he's got a forthcoming book, How to Raise a Boy. That's why both of our guests are here. It's very, very obvious. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Michael Reichert, just really quickly, how did things end with you and your son then?
So there's two sides to the story. For my son, I think it went fine. I don't know that he ever figured out how to become fully a part of that particular group of boys. As they got older and older, their lives got rougher and harder in different ways. But I think that more importantly, I think there was outcomes for me. I was reflecting on that story over many years, and Dan Siegel, who's a neuroscientist and written a book called Parenting from the Inside Out, makes a distinction between parenting from the high road and parenting from the low road, I had to really look at where I was coming from, and were my fears causing me to push my son toward that man box, or was I instead thinking clearly about his possibilities, activating his resourcefulness and problem solving? And I think it really was learning to monitor myself and not just pass along intergenerational prejudices.
Well, it's interesting because, and I'll put this to you, Michael Lindsay, dealing with both of your stories and what we hear about our fathers' anxieties about their sons. Are their sons going to be tough enough, strong enough to make it in this mean, cold world at times? What do you think that anxiety is about?
Well, I think it's about wanting to prepare their sons for what they perceive to be a hostile, harsh world. And let me just add to Michael's excellent story to illustrate the point that, you know, it's not always about the men who are very concerned about their sons and how their sons are raised. My research on single mothers who are raising their sons, in this instance, it was African-American mothers rearing their sons as the sole parent. It's a misnomer to think that mothers do not always consider these issues as well. And in that study, one of the things that I identified, I think it's a misnomer to think that mothers are raising their children alone, their mm-hmm. sons alone. The mothers were actually intentional about creating environments, mentoring relationships, other family members who could be role models. They were intentional about putting those individuals in their sons' lives. They were intentional about having their sons be involved in team sports to emphasize peer relationships, but also another sort of access, if you will, to another supportive and caring adult in terms of coaches. And then I also found that these mothers sort of emphasize spirituality and sort of this existential notion of success in life, that, you know, there's meaning in suffering and there's power in the experience of good and bad things in life, and that if you channel through it and move ahead, embrace those lessons to be learned from those experiences, then it's a part of your sort of healthy development.
Sure.
And so mothers are very concerned and very intentional about these sort of issues as well.
Well, it seems that all those things would help to create a young man or even an older man that would have access to all those feelings that we know that they have. I do want to talk about, I don't like the term toxic masculinity. I'm not comfortable with that, but hypermasculinity, I think, is one way to describe it. And Michael Reichert, I'm looking at you. I want to figure out how to make the connection between why we don't want boys to cry and what hypermasculinity is all about.
Big topic. Where to start? So George Orwell, the British writer, wrote an essay called "Shooting an Elephant" back in the 1930s. He himself was a British soldier in Burma, and the story he tells is about a young adult soldier who has to shoot an elephant because the elephant has run amok in the village. And he has to not only shoot the elephant, but he has to shoot the elephant with no visible regrets or trepidation or compassion. He simply has to dispatch the elephant in a coldly efficient way. And in that story, Orwell strikes a phrase that has become a real, I think, important one. He says, "He wears a mask and he grows to fit it."
Ah.
And that sentence became the aphorism guiding the movie "The Mask You Live In," created by the Representation Project. And I think that the point altogether is that if we cut boys off from the community of resources around them that know them as human beings, that care about their feelings, that are resonant and act as holding environments for those boys' hearts. The boys themselves will grow to fit those constraints. And we have the phenomenon of adult men becoming numb. Bill Pollack uses the word alexithymic, no words for feelings.
Completely sort of cut off from the language of feelings.
Yeah, yeah. When I was 25 years old, I had a moment in my life where I had a sad thing happen to me. And I remember sitting on a bench in beautiful British Columbia, gorgeous day, sitting on the bench and reflecting on knowing I was sad but unable to summon those feelings, almost as if there was this baffling between me and my feelings that I had incorporated over many, many years of not practicing coding language with feelings.
That's very lonely, I would think. And to you, Michael Lindsay, it's interesting that when we think about masculinity, it's different spelling. There's the word mask in there, mask with a K, as opposed to mask with a C. How do you see hypermasculinity?
Well, I think it's certainly problematic. It is a tough one because there's these overarching pressures to, and really gendered in the way that we socialize both boys and girls. But, you know, this concept that Michael just mentioned, alexithymia, no words for feelings, is really, really powerful because hypermasculinity is really about more physical and reactive as opposed to using your words and being articulate and verbal in your expression. I mean, it's what we see in terms of, you know, the health disparities. You know, voluminous scholars have talked about health disparities, particularly among men. And for example, black men have the highest rates of the most treatable diseases, right? That if they were engaged in help seeking and use of preventative and usual care, then it would mitigate those, you know, persistent symptoms that lead to diseases. And so I think the hypermasculinity piece is really problematic because it doesn't, you know, sort of lend to men using their words, expressing their pain, expressing emotional and physical pain for that matter. And there's this sort of ethic around, you know, keeping it close to the vest or not appearing to be weak because, you know, in our society, we prey upon the vulnerable. And that's the sort of mask that, if you will, that men wear and that we socialize boys to wear in terms of, you know, channeling through this really tough and difficult world. And these are the things that men need to do to, you know, be successful in it. And it becomes problematic because, as I mentioned earlier, it blunts that range of emotional expression and articulation of what's going on inside, real, imagined, otherwise.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Michael Lindsay from NYU, New York University. Michael Reichert with us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Michael Reichert is Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives. We're talking about boys' lives in this hour of Radio Times. I want to read a bunch of comments, but let me put to you, Michael Reichert, but do you think things are also changing for boys? And I can speak more anecdotally than I can based on research when I see my son raising his son and I see his friends raising their children. It feels different. And this looks like there's more involvement and there's more emotion, at least from the outside looking in. Are things changing, do you think?
Very much. I think we're in a remarkably promising moment where, for the first time in I think in history, it may be possible for us to think about boys as human beings and not simply fit them into the man box, not simply sacrifice them and their humanity for the sake of the outcomes that we believe we need from males. There's a book, there's a whole conversation, I'm sure Michael's familiar with this conversation, about the boy crisis. In fact, there's books like The Demise of Guys, The End of Men, Boys Falling Behind, The Trouble with Boys. These are some of the more recent titles.
Well, yep.
Yep. And yet what I actually think is true is not that there's some new crisis in boyhood, but that we're actually able to perceive the crisis really for the first time and be honest about the fact that it's been true forever. Mm-hmm. Boys, for example, educationally have been behind girls in terms of achievement and effort since the turn of the century.
This century or the one before?
The one before.
The one before, yeah, yeah. Okay. Let me read an email from Andrea and Michael Lindsay. This, I think, is at you. She says, first of all, I'm glad you have Lindsay there. Please have him speak on the difficulty and the anxiety that comes from raising black males, specifically as they go from being cute little boys, society begins to vilify them and treat them as dangerous and violent threats. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So what happens is that, you know, black boys, there was a study that came out, I want to say in 2016, a Yale study that talked about the fact that even as early as preschools, that black boys or Latino boys are subject to implicit bias, right? That their behavioral expressions are interpreted differently. At the McSilver Institute, we do a lot of school-based work and in terms of research and mental health intervention delivery. And what we found is that the expressions and behaviors of boys are interpreted differently, which often leads to suspensions or expulsions at higher disproportionate rates. So these are things that accompany, if you will, the experience mm-hmm. of raising black boys and some of the challenges that they're experiencing. A recent study by Jeff Bridge and colleagues and the journal JAMA Pediatrics in 2015 and then was recently updated in May of this year, their data was recently updated that black boys between the ages of 5 and 12 years old now have the highest rates of suicide more than any other racial or ethnic group in that age category.
Yeah, I mean, that's a show in and of itself. What explains that?
Yeah, so my research has pointed to about three reasons why. One, given the subject of this conversation, we socialize boys differently. We tell them to man up. We tell them boys don't cry. And a 2010 study that I conducted on help-seeking behaviors among black boys and their experiences with depression, boys who were depressed talked about the struggles they had with acknowledging their emotional pain or going to someone to ask for help because they felt they were going to be, you know, preyed upon or ignored and told to get along with it. So that's problematic. The other issue, the second issue, is the lack of mental health treatment. Obviously, there is a stigma associated with mental health treatment or the acknowledgement of a mental health issue. And so boys, again, are not able to share those experiences mm-hmm. with people because of how stigmatized mental illness and mental health treatment is. There's this culture of get over it, tough it out. Some may think that it's a financial issue, but some of the research I've done and others have done suggest that lack of financial access does not totally explain it. And then I think, finally,
and just briefly, we're almost up in a break, and I want to give Michael Reichert a chance to weigh in as well. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say that a lack of awareness of the signs and symptoms, misinterpretation of the behaviors, particularly for those who are on the front lines, mm-hmm. teachers and parents, and so then the boys' issues are ignored, and thus leads to the symptoms exacerbating.
Well, it's interesting because Michael Reichert, you are the director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives. do we speak to boys differently? Should we speak to boys differently when we want to understand their lives?
The thing that, while Michael was speaking, I was thinking about the work I do at the Haverford School, where...
Which is an all-boys school.
Which is an all-boys school, 1,000 boys from 3 years old to 18 years old. And the school has supported an emotional literacy program for 11th and 12th grade boys. It's a voluntary program. 40 to 50 boys will gather together in a room for an hour and a half over pizza. And what we do is we essentially invite them to talk to each other. We set up the exercises. We hit topics that are particularly important, like relationships with their parents or relationships with girls or relationships with each other, sex, drugs. And we invite them to actually share with each other what those subjects involve in terms of their emotional experience. What I want to say is that what we find is it's a construction of the environment that boys operate in. When you give boys permission to be themselves, to take the mask off, what's right there is a fully alive, beating heart. And as they practice putting words to feelings and opening themselves up, allowing themselves to be vulnerable, what we see is that their humanity is undiminished.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about boys in this hour of Radio Times, specifically how to raise boys, how to deal with the kind of hyper-masculinity, the kind of masks that boys often feel like they have to have, sometimes even into manhood as well. That's Michael Reichert, who joins us along with Michael Lindsay, and you can join us as well. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Michael Lindsay from New York University, Michael Reichert, who heads up the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about boys in this hour of Radio Times. Michael Reichert, let me go back to you. You talked about this group that you run at the Haverford School, an all-boys school in suburban Philadelphia. How do you create this environment where boys, a bunch of boys together, feel comfortable enough or safe enough to be able to explore and expose that more vulnerable side of themselves?
Yeah, I'd like to claim that I'm brilliant and figured something really tricky out, but the truth really is that right behind those masks and the school culture that they have had to operate in, the broader culture, masculinity culture they operate in, right behind that is a young man quite ready to resist that being shoved into a box socialization. And so what we have to do is in some ways merely give them permission to be themselves. Mm-hmm. So the question really is, how do we give them permission? How do we invite them to be themselves with each other? And we do that through a variety of things. Probably most powerful, according to the boys, is we do what we call demonstrations, where one boy each time will have a turn in front of everyone else. And often those are boys, a norm develops for the group in which they really have each other's backs, they really support each other in sort of the best of brotherhood ways. And the boy talks about sometimes awful things. One boy talked, it was a boy from Philadelphia, who talked about when he was 7 years old, seeing his best friend shot while they were at the playground. Another young man had lost his mother and hadn't told anybody about it.
Powerful stories.
Boys that are, just the most heart-wrenching stories. And these boys had kept these things to themselves, invited out in the open by their brotherhood of support. What emerges is a wholeheartedness and emotionality that's deep and profound, sobbing, crying, raging, and the group, in a certain sense, becomes what we call the holding environment for these boys to be real with each other. And, again, I'd like to say that I'm fantastic at doing this, but it's the boys themselves right. That did it.
But it sounds like we need to ask. I mean, part of it,
need to invite.
Or invite. I mean,
that's
we
right.
need to want to know about what their
exactly,
lives
Marty.
Are
exactly.
about. Let me get, it looks like Rick from Warminster to join our conversation. And, Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Very
sure.
interesting conversation.
Thanks.
I was in the service, Army, 26 years, served two wars, Vietnam and the Gulf War. And when we get up to the colonel rank, you get the psychological analysis down at the War College at Carlisle.
Oh, sure.
And they asked, what was your education? Where'd you grow up? I said, Irish Catholic family, Brooklyn, grandma strong, mom strong, and then 12 years of nuns. And the psychologist said, he said, there's the key. He said, and like all these other macho colonels running around here, you have a sensitivity towards people, towards communication, that I find very rare in the type of occupation that you've chosen. So I just thought I'd share that with you.
I'm glad you did, Rick. I appreciate the call. And Michael Lindsay, that really underscores what you were saying earlier about boys having women in their lives. Obviously, I think we all need all kinds of people in our lives. But here's a guy in the military raised largely by women being able to show that more relational side of himself.
Absolutely. As Michael was talking about his program on emotional literacy, it reminded me of an important set of work that we do at McSilver Institute, which is a high school-based program called Step Up, which targets kids who are on the cusp of failing out of high school, but it does provide emotional literacy and otherwise. And what I was thinking about was the fact that there's some folks out there thinking perhaps, well, do I need to have an all-boys group? Our groups are co-ed, and I think there is a possibility and great potential. Our data suggests that boys and girls can come together and talk about these issues and really help to sort of be in touch with their emotions and to develop that, you know, rapport with one another. We have one-to-one in mentoring and also sort of group-based mentoring that helps boys and girls. We've had great success with it. It's framed on a positive youth development framework, which seeks to build kids' assets while reducing the challenges in their lives or giving them the tools to address those challenges. And so, again, it just made me sort of think about the fact that boys and girls can perhaps come together and you can reconcile these issues
sure.
in a collective sort of way.
Let me read some more emails. One from Kristen who says, particularly after the Me Too movement, please ask your guests about what parents should do to teach their boys how to treat and have healthy relationships with girls and or women. Let me toss that to you, Michael Reichert.
Well, just building on what Michael was saying, you know, in this Me Too time, I think lots of males feel threatened, feel on shaky ground, deservedly. You know, I think a lot of what we've learned about being male, you know, the traditional ways of functioning, assumptions about male supremacy, and so forth, you know, the devaluing of women, the trivialization of women's lives, you know, just all those different features that are part of the broader package of masculine socialization are being challenged and undone. And I think that the good news, I think, here is that if we can actually move a lot of those assumptions out of the way and not find ourselves in the position of blindly reenacting and reinstilling those values and virtues, I think we actually will find that our boys manage to be creative and adapt to the present circumstances quite creatively. There's a movement going on in men's work. We call it men's rights, and it's a reactive approach to feminism and the Me Too time, basically saying feminism is men's enemy. And actually what I think and what I find with the boys I work with is that it's natural for males to want to be respectful and close to women as much as they are respectful and close to males. And it's only the distortions that get incorporated into that in that traditional socialization that I think move boys away from that understanding, that almost that disconnection that sets in.
Michael Lindsay, I want to pick up on something you said earlier, and this is about the rising suicide rate of young boys of color, boys ages of 5 to 11, seeing that on the rise. And obviously this is an expression of a deep despair and deep depression. And I'm thinking not just for young black boys, but for all boys. Does depression look different than it does for, let's say, young girls? Do we know? Is depression depression, or is there something else at work here?
We just published a study in the Journal for the Society for Social Work and Research, where we interviewed or surveyed about 800 black adolescents around their depression symptoms.
Yeah.
And what we found was that relative to how whites have or kids and other ethnic groups have defined their depression symptoms, for black adolescents, depression does look different. And one of the ways that it is commonly featured is through relationship challenges or sort of the caustic nature of those relationships incite symptoms in such a big way. We haven't found that there is a gender difference in terms of how black boys and girls sort of exhibit their symptoms. But I think that when you talk about the issue of suicidality in that 5 to 12-year-old age range, I think it has a lot to do with the socialization experiences. In fact, from 1999 through 2015, there were 1,300 children ages 5 to 12 who died by suicide. That's mm-hmm. one child under the age of 13 who commits suicide almost every 5 days. Mm-hmm. 76% of them were male. And so I think across the board, there is really truly a dynamic around the socialization experiences. And it just so happened that principally among those males, it was African American or black males who right. had the highest rates. And so I just really point to that socialization, lack of mental health treatment, and the stigmatization of mental illness and treatment as primary right. factors.
A real call for help there. Let me read an email from Pamela. She says, I remember holding my son once when he was 5 and lanky and sprawling all over my lap and thinking how this cuddliness wouldn't last. It didn't, but by his choice, I believe. And I think she raises some interesting points. One is the kind of rough and tumble play that we associate with boys. And I'm looking at you, Michael Riker, because my understanding of in the animal world, male animals engage in rough and tumble play more than girls. And I wouldn't want to turn boys into girls as we get them to be more emotional and more open. But can you factor some of that stuff in?
Oh, yeah. there's been lots of conversation about how much of what emerges in male development is genetically programmed.
Yeah.
You know, how much is driven by hormones and so forth. And I just think that it's almost impossible to tell at this point in history because our eyes, the eyes of the observer, are so influenced by the assumptions that we make. Niobe Way, who's a psychologist at NYU, a colleague of Michael's at NYU, wrote a book called Deep Secrets, the Crisis of Connection. And her studies have been about male friendships. And what she finds is that unlike the stereotypes of the arelational male, boys love their friends, depend on their friends, live for their friends. But as they get older, they feel this pressure to distance themselves, to become more independent, to form heterosexual relationships as their primary supports. And her stories are so poignant because she talks about the mental health and emotional effects of finding yourself more and more alone as a result of that kind of conditioning. So what I would say to Pamela is it's important to understand how much of what your son is responding to is what we call demand behavior. He's reading the social cues. He's internalizing them. I don't actually think that there's any necessary conflict between being rough and tumble, aggressive, and needing to cuddle.
You can do both, right?
We do them all.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Claire. Very young boys need a bit more instruction that it's okay and worthwhile to befriend and interact with girls they're not, quote unquote, interested in, if not at last into adulthood, with men who organize women into two boxes, those they can sleep with and those they can just ignore. A tweet from Max. Both men and women caretakers must also learn about their own emotional literacy. Children model what they see and hear. Thank you for addressing this extremely important challenge, especially in these times of bullying from the top that expressed as being strong. We have just a couple of minutes here before we have to say goodbye. And Michael Lindsay, some people are in despair and feel as if we're in some crisis when it comes to boys and men. Do you think that's true? Do you share that?
No, I don't think we're in a crisis. I mean, I think part of the kind of conversations we're having now are really important to changing the narrative about, you know, what it means to be masculine and male, if you will. In fact, on that cue of changing the narrative, we actually at McSilver earlier this year produced a podcast series called Changing the Narrative on Black Men and Boys, where it's a 14-part podcast series that I encourage our listeners to check it out, which talks about the range of experiences that Black men and boys have, mostly based in the United States context. But what we're doing is we're laying out these issues, challenging conventional or historical thoughts about what it means to be male, Black male in America, and really being prescriptive about things that can help change the narrative. So I'm not sure that there's a crisis per se as much as it is about talking about these issues.
Sure.
and convening, you know, thought leaders to, like Michael, to help us think through some of the challenges that Black boys and men in general are facing.
Let me read a Facebook comment. Michael Riker, we're almost out of time, but Mary wants to know, what do your guests think about parents raising their children in a, quote, gender-free way? Is that possible?
Essentially, I think we all strive not to impart prejudice, and if that means not simply assuming that our sons need to be a certain way or our daughters need to be a certain other way, if it means that, I think that that's important, and that is, in fact, trying to be gender neutral or gender open. But I think that the import of the question on a broader level is that we are the creators, the builders of boyhood. It's not the boys. The boys fit themselves into the opportunity structures that we create for them. I'll stop there.
Okay. They're playing my song, so we do have to stop. My thanks to you, Michael Riker. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Nice speaking with you, Michael.
Nice to have you both with us. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guests. Michael Riker is a psychologist in clinical practice, a consultant at the Haverford School, executive director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives, writes a column for Yahoo News called The Me Too Guide to Raising Boys, and he's got a book coming out called How to Raise a Boy. Michael Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's the executive director of the McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research, also professor of poverty policies or poverty studies at NYU. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. And our engineer, Diana Martinez, the show Radio Times, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern.